Hello and welcome to an all-new episode of the 3-Bid League Podcast. As always, I am your host, Tyler, and this is going to be a two-parter here to preview these first-round NCAA tournament games. First off, Zach Joachim of the Richmond Times-Dispatch and I are going to do something a little different than the typical first-round previews. We're going to go through and really just try to figure out the keys of the game for VCU and North Carolina, piece them together as we go. As opposed to our normal bringing in an outside guest, trying to just get a scouting report on that team. The second part, we're going to do just that. Lance McCurley of UGASports.com is going to join me. We're going to break down Georgia ahead of that matchup with St. Louis. Quick NIT update, George Mason and Davidson lost. George Washington and Dayton won. At the time I'm recording this, St. Joe's still has not played yet. By the time you're hearing it, they have. So there's your first round NIT update. Let's get into those game previews. All right. We're going to preview VCU and North Carolina. For this one, I am joined by Zach Joachim of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Zach, thank you for joining me.
Tyler, what's up, my friend? It is always a privilege, and as we discussed on Sunday after the A-10 final, I am honored, distinguished to be a part of the nine-time club, right? And getting the 3-Bid League quarter zip from you. So thank you so much for that. I was rocking it in the airport on the way back to Richmond.
I think this might only count as half an appearance, though, because we are doing this jointly. This is a simulcast across the 3-Bid League and Up the Coast podcast here. We're going to switch up the typical team preview here. Normally, I bring in an expert guest and just kind of have them go through the simple stuff. But I'm going to hope that my own knowledge of these two teams can supplement a little bit here. I'll be playing the role of the North Carolina guy, partially because my first choice Carolina man had a scheduling conflict. So I'm going to just do it. We'll go back and forth, just try to hammer out the keys to the game here and just see where it leads. But Zach, because we did talk about it briefly when we were doing the VCU recap on Sunday, and I know you've been doing some North Carolina research as well. What have you kind of fallen into as being the number one key to this game?
I think it's the Djokovic and Vassar. Is that how you say
Vassar. His last name?
Henri Vassar. I think it's that matchup between those two guys, because I don't think either team has like a really obvious, you know, second body that you can put on the seven footers down there. Djokovic is 6'11". But those guys have been key to these team success this year. And obviously Vassar has stepped up with Caleb Wilson out. And so I think a lot of what, you know, VCU fans and reporters have been trying to figure out is, what does this North Carolina team look like without Wilson out there? Obviously he's a top tier NBA draft prospect, broke his thumb dunking during practice on March 5th, and he's out for the postseason. Now, they've played some decent stretches without him this year, so it's not totally new for them to be figuring out how to play without their star player, but he led them in pretty much every statistical category this year in points, rebounds. I think it's the only statistic he didn't is assists. Blocks, he was up there too. And so it seems to me like Vassar has really stepped up since he went down, and that he's the focal point for them. Interesting stuff from Lazar Djokovic. Obviously, he's Serbian and Vassar is Estonian. And so a lot of those Euroball guys are familiar with one another. And Djokovic said like he knew of him coming up, and Vassar played at Real Madrid, obviously a huge club over in Europe before. And so he already had prior familiarity with his game before starting to study him in these next couple of days. But that's the matchup that I'm pointing to, man. And getting into like the nuts and bolts of how they match up against one another. Vassar shot 42% from three on the season, so he can really stretch the floor. Djokovic is pretty good from outside as well. Not nearly that clip. I think he was in the high 30s. And he'll pick and choose his spots to shoot it from outside. But he led the A-10 in free throw attempts on the season with 206. He's excelled at getting the line all year for VCU and hit some clutch free throws late in that win over Dayton. And so I think if there's a path to victory for me, for VCU in that matchup, is it's Djokovic trying to go at him in the paint early and maybe get him in foul trouble, because UNC has leaned on him so much, and it seems like they could be disrupted significantly offensively if he's off the floor. And I think he shoots, Bashar shoots 62% from three. I looked at KenPom earlier. UNC is not a good free throw shooting team. They're like 315th in the country. And so if VCU can make this a physical kind of ugly game, and it'll depend a little bit on how it's called with the officials. Like, I think if this game is called pretty tight, then that would really behoove VCU, because they're the better free throw shooting team. They're 15th in the country in free throw rate. And so they've excelled at getting there all year. And so I think that would be one of, just looking at these teams on paper, that's one of the clearest routes for VCU, is for Djokovic to try and get Bashar in foul trouble early, and for the Rams to muddy this game up, make it physical, try and use their depth and their free throw shooting, to make it kind of an ugly game and get to the line at a high clip.
So that's my number one. And you also hit on one of my others kind of unknowingly during that in one of your stats there. It's what does VCU do with Vassar? They have not faced a guy anywhere like this all season. I think the closest comp is Robbie Avila over at St. Louis, a very similar body type player, incredibly skilled big. Now, Avila, a little bit more perimeter oriented, Vassar can operate on the perimeter, just a far more physical, powerful low post force, though. And I'm just not sure that VCU has the right guy to handle both elements of that. I mean, Djokovic can obviously body him up, but I think Michael Bell's going to struggle against him in the post. And Djokovic unquestionably does not have the quickness to deal with him off the bounce. And this is the kind of game where, and we might have to see Keyshawn Mitchell a little bit for VCU just to give Vassar a different look. On the other end, you mentioned the fouling. This is a North Carolina team that's top 10 in the nation in not sending their opponents to the free throw line. The big reason, they just don't commit many fouls on the floor. Those guards are so good at not getting handsy. They're not going to let you draw those little ticky-tack on the perimeter fouls. Keeps teams out of the bonus. And then Wilson was spectacular at never fouling guys. Their one weak spot is Vassar. He's the only guy on this team who is prone to kind of getting himself into foul trouble. But for a VCU team that is so reliant on going to the free throw line, and think back to that A-10 championship game at those last 9 minutes where they couldn't make a field goal. North Carolina is just not going to put them in a position for a Terrence Hill or a Nick Lewis or a Jadrian Tracy to get themselves cheap points at the line the back end of halves.
And Wilson was leading them in blocks too at 1.4 per game. And then Vachar is their second. He's got 1.2, right? So, I mean, in terms of rim protectors, like, after that, Jaren Stevenson is at 0.7. Like, Vachar is their best rim protector. And so I think that's another, element of it that points to, if VCU getting him in foul trouble, it can really change the complexion of this game, because then you get your rim protector out of there. You would think that opens up some driving lanes. And to your point, that seems, like, because Djokovic has been so strong at getting there all year, that maybe VCU tries to play through him early in this game and make Vachar play defense. Because getting him off the floor would be huge for VCU, man. And I'm with you. I think Michael Bell is a great defender. Like, his versatility on the perimeter was huge for VCU in the A-10 tournament. This is not a good matchup for him. And maybe VCU does go to Keyshawn Mitchell a little bit, who's played sparingly for stretches of this year, but it's just another, 6'10" body that you can throw down there. He's a pretty wiry guy. Like, he's one of those bigs that came up as a guard and has good perimeter skills, but has some work to do just in terms of filling out his frame. And I think he would struggle to bump around with Vachar down low. But that's the kind of guy that you can throw out there for 10, 15 minutes of this game just to be a body and to pick up fouls. And that's okay, because you're not worried if he's off the floor, and to spell Djokovic a little bit if you need to. Because Djokovic isn't the perfect matchup for Vachar, but there's just not another guy that VCU can go to, who's got the size and strength to bump around with him down low. So that's the matchup I'm looking at, man. And I had a fun anecdote from Phil Martelli earlier today, because Duke is playing in Greenville earlier in the day, right? And Greenville's about 6 hours from Richmond. We did the drive down here yesterday. It's about 4 hours from Chapel Hill. So Carolina, obviously an enormous brand, great fan base. Like, they're going to travel well. VCU's going to travel well too from this game. There's a lot of VCU fans hoping that there'll be plenty of Duke fans who come, to the second game, like after they play Siena earlier in the day. I think it's a separate ticket, so like you have to go out and get another ticket. But without much Duke hates North Carolina, maybe some of those fans are gonna, want to stay for the rest of the day and turn in their Duke blue for some black and gold and cheer on the Rams. And we asked Phil Martelli about that, and he talked about, so in 2003, when he's a senior at St. Joseph's, they get a number 10 seed in the NCAA tournament, and they're going to play number 7 Auburn. And he said, like, right after the matchup was announced and before St. Joseph's assistants got back to their office, Alabama had like faxed over all of their scouting report that they had on Auburn. And so they were trying to help them out, as much as they could against their rivals. I don't believe that Duke has faxed over any scouting reports, but obviously those rivalries run deep. And so I'm sure there will be a lot of Blue Devils fans, and VCU is hoping that could even it out. And if the Duke fans in there are cheering for VCU, then maybe we get a pretty split arena that seats about 15,000 with the Greenville Swamp Rabbits, which is just a phenomenal mascot. I've been enjoying that this week too. It's a minor league hockey team. It's also Furman's home arena, and it was really cool being in there earlier. And I'm excited to see what it looks like tomorrow.
Yeah, nobody does good old-fashioned hate like Duke fans, other than probably the UConn fans. I think that's the one where if they had a chance to go root against like Providence or St. John's, they would absolutely fill the place just to boo their rivals. But one of the things I'm wondering about here is what Carolina's going to get in terms of wing scoring in this game. Seth Trimble is probably gonna have to work his ass off in this game because he's basically the only person who can viably try to guard Terrence Hill. But at the same time, I'm assuming VCU is gonna throw Brandon Jennings on him on the other end, and he is just gonna have to work all the way through this game. The one guy that VCU doesn't have a proper matchup for is Luka Bogovac, just this bigger wing, a guy who is an incredibly streaky scorer. But it's, I guess, like Barry Evans that you might have to go big and play Evans and Bell at the 3 and 4 at certain times. But at the same time, Bogovac also made 1 3 in his last 4 games. And it comes and goes so aggressively for him after he was awesome in February, had his best shooting run of the entire season. He's been ice cold as of late.
I would be interested too to see if Phil will go to some bigger lineups and play Lazar, Barry, and Bell all out there at the same time, because he's kind of done the opposite. Like in the like when VCU has been playing their best ball, like over the course of the season, he's done a lot of Bell at the five lineups with them kind of going slower. That worked to great effect against St. Joseph's with pulling Ajogbor away from the basket. But I don't think this matchup lends itself to that, to your point. I think it lends it to the opposite with him maybe going a little bigger. And then that begs the question, what do you do with the guard rotations? Does this mean this isn't exactly like a Tyrell Ward or Jadrian Tracy game, and you've just got two of Hill, Jennings, or Nick Lewis out there at the same time? Another fascinating aspect that I've been wondering about is the pace. Because it's two teams that, like Phil said, North Carolina will get out and run when the opportunity is there for them. But according to like the KenPom, the tempo, VCU is, what are they? They're like 115 in the country in tempo, and North Carolina, here it is. Yeah. VCU is 116th in adjusted tempo, and North Carolina is, where'd it go? 144. So like the numbers tell you that VCU wants to run a little more than UNC does. But I'm not sure. What do you think favors North Carolina or VCU? Is it a slower paced game, or is there one of these teams that really wants to get out and run in this matchup?
I'm not sure it matters in this one. I feel like it's going to depend on how teams are getting out and running. I mean, North Carolina, for a defense that never forces turnovers, I think they're going to struggle to do so in this one too. I think it's probably just a wash, honestly, because VCU's
And
not going to give
VCU,
Carolina the ball.
who's been good at taking care of the ball of late, right? And yeah, I'm looking at their metrics right now. 344th nationally in defensive turnover percentage. Like, that's wild. 333rd in non-steal turnover percentage, 317th in steal percentage. Like, they do not turn people over a great deal. And the other thing that I've seen people point to as well, they're 216th in three-point defense. Like, opposing teams are shooting 34.5% against them, so they can give it up from outside. And it's a VCU team that can obviously get hot, and they've got, what was it, like the metric that I saw on ESPN earlier. I think nine guys who've made at least 18 threes on the season. Essentially, they were trying to depict the fact that you've got guys who can shoot it all over this VCU team. And so that would be another path to victory, is if they can get going from outside. I'm not sure contesting on the perimeter is North Carolina's greatest strength either.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next one. You're dealing with the second worst 3-point shooting defense in ACC play this year, a well below average group for the full year in North Carolina. VCU was awesome shooting the three last week. They broke the 40% mark twice. They also have only broken it twice in the last 9 games. This was a team that did not shoot well down the stretch overall. So I guess we probably do need to just go into a couple of the random characters in this game, because unless Vassar just completely wreaks havoc and we see a repeat of his game like he had in the loss against Clemson in the ACC quarterfinals, where he goes for 25 and 17, then we're going to start looking into these random role guys. And this freshman point guard battle, Nick Lewis against Derek Dixon, two super inconsistent young guys who look like young guys a lot. And if one of them can have one of their better games in this one and the other one's stuck to the bench in crunch time, that may well decide it.
Two guys who, correct me if I'm wrong here. I'm sorry if the sound just went off there. I was pulling up the ESPN page, looking at North Carolina's stats. Is Derek Dixon also the Gonzaga guy who went to Gonzaga High School? Because there's a guy on this UNC roster who was high school teammates with Nick
Yeah,
Lewis.
oh yeah, I saw someone say that on Twitter the other day, which
And
makes
so
this
they
even better.
Exactly. And so they've got a bunch of familiarity with each other. Yeah, I'm looking at the roster right now. Yeah, Derek Dixon is a Vienna, Virginia native, and went to Gonzaga. So him and Nick were high school teammates. So that's an awesome matchup. And I'm sure they've got a lot of familiarity with each other's games that probably cancels each other out. I'm not sure, gives either an advantage here. But again, what we talked about too after that Sunday win over Dayton, like Nick Lewis, 11 rebounds in that game, 10 of them were defensive. And so I'd say that's a key that a lot of people can look for, is VCU is at their best offensively when Nick Lewis is grabbing a defensive rebound and getting out and running and leading the break. And I think those will be VCU's best opportunities to, when you've got your point guard who loves to push the pace, if he can get a defensive rebound off a miss, and then VCU can get going down the floor with him being the floor general, then you can spread your shooters out to the corners. And I think that's probably the instance in which they're likely to get really good 3-point looks, again, against a team which has not been, has been one of the worst in the ACC at contesting on the perimeter. And I think that's going to be some of VCU's best opportunities to get out and run a little bit and to put together a 10-2 run or something like that in this game that can swing some momentum in their favor. Because, I mean, every 3-point shooting team is, that relies heavily on that is streaky, right? And you alluded to it, like VCU was really good at the A-10 tournament, and they had some games down the stretch of the regular season that they struggled in. But Phil Martelli has talked about that. I think that's one of the greatest strengths of this 16 out of 17, streak that VCU has got going, where they ended the season winning 16 out of 17 games, that they learned to win in different ways. And they had some rock fights that they were able to pull out when they weren't shooting it well from outside, and they were able to rely on their defense. And then they had some more higher scoring games where both teams got going up and down the floor and they were hitting from outside. So I think VCU is built with the versatility to win this game, in different styles. I think a lot of people, does it make you nervous how many people are picking VCU? Because I've seen that around the country. I mean, I think ESPN had a story earlier today saying that they were the most likely seed of 11 or lower throughout the whole tournament to win their first round game. The game, a 39% chance. That's about where KenPom has it too. Like, this game is kind of 60-40, in favor of UNC. And we were talking about it before we went on here. Like, the St. Louis, Georgia line is the same as this line is. Like, it's 2.5. And UNC's favored by 2.5. And so everything is telling us that it's going to be a close game and that VCU has every chance to get their first NCAA tournament win in 10 years. Does that make you nervous at all? Do you wish that they, were more of underdogs here?
I think the problem with this year's bracket is that there's just not that many great upset picks. And so you glance around, everyone hated the first four teams this year. And you get on to the 5-12 games, everyone loves all the five seeds. And so you're basically looking at a situation where it's VCU, South Florida, maybe Akron over Texas Tech. There's just not that many sexy ways to go here.
I was gonna say Akron too. That's the one that I like, and I have familiarity with South Florida because VCU obviously played them earlier in the year. They're playing Louisville. That's a 6-11, right?
Who is also missing their best player like Carolina is.
Now UNC would probably be seeded higher, right? If they weren't missing Caleb Wilson, and so one would think maybe that's baked into the seed a little bit. But that's definitely, and they've just lost their last two games too. I mean, what was it, a 15-point loss to Duke at Cameron to end the regular season, and then a 1-point loss to Clemson, 80-79, in the ACC quarterfinals. That makes them look a little vulnerable, and it's hard not to feel the opposite way about a VCU team that just, was pretty comprehensive in winning the A-10 tournament. The only, like as we discussed, the game that tested them the most was that quarterfinal game against Duquesne. And it feels like they're playing their best basketball of the season, and that North Carolina is kind of faltering without their best player, and that it's the right moment for these teams to be matched up for VCU.
So I will flip that with my one last possibility I'm thinking about in this game. The door is open to a Carolina just smothering here because Lazar Djokovic coming off the worst week of his season, the A-10 tournament, really being a non-factor for three games against a North Carolina group that is so good at just sealing off the rim, even without Wilson. When Vassar and Jaren Stevenson are out there together, VCU is just going to struggle to get downhill. If they can't generate one-on-one baskets from Djokovic. And it does feel like this could turn into something we saw in November, December. VCU started to get 3-point happy against better defenses. And it could turn into something like that NC State game here real quick, where they're just bombing away. And if VCU's shooting under 30, I'm gonna say under 35% from three, and they don't have an answer for Vassar, North Carolina's probably blowing them out.
I'm with you. I certainly see that route too. I want to say that in the back half of the season, that VCU to a degree fixed that issue and was able to understand, games that they couldn't get 3-point happy when it wasn't falling. But I can certainly see that route if they're not hitting from outside, they're not able to penetrate. I mean, they need Terrence Hill to do what he did at the A-10 tournament, right? And to be a driver that can get into the paint, hit all of the mid-range shots that he hit. Those should probably be open for him, because so much of collapsing a defense for VCU comes off of Hill being able to penetrate with his dribble drive game. And so they're going to need him to be that, 18, 20 point leading scorer who's able to beat guys off the dribble, in order to open up everything for all the other guys. Or maybe they can get going in transition, like we talked about with Nick Lewis, and pushing the tempo a little bit and being able to spread the floor a little bit that way. But I'm with you. I can certainly see that route where if, a few shots don't get in early and they get 3-point happy and they're not able to penetrate, and then Bashar is just killing them on the inside, on the other side. That's definitely the route for UNC to win this game by 10, 15 points.
Yeah, I think it's something that they do need to watch out for. But regardless, this should be a super fun game. Any other thoughts that you haven't gotten off about this matchup?
Tyrell Ward, I would throw out there too. I mean, he's been such a big part of VCU's best basketball in the back half of the season. There were those long stretches earlier where he wasn't playing. And I think his resurgence has very much come in tandem with VCU's best basketball in the year. And they're going to need that bench, that was fifth nationally in bench points per game to show up. They're going to need Ward to hit a couple threes and be the defender that he was, as we talked about on Sunday too, with three blocks and three steals in that A-10 final. They're going to need him to show up. And I would be fascinated to hear Hubert Davis talk about the preparation for Hill and Bell off the bench, right? Because like Phil Martelli talked about that at length, and I was fascinated with what he said during the A-10 tournament when Matt Shelton-Ide from Ram Nation asked, like, did you really wrestle with wanting to start Terrence Hill like for long stretches this year? He was your leading scorer analytics-wise, your best offensive player. Like, did you want to put him in the starting lineup? And Phil said, no, I really never did, because I love, the chess piece that is in terms of preparation. Because when you're an opposing team, a lot of the time when you're doing your walkthrough, you're talking about the starters for the other team, right? And this guy, is guarding him, and here's how we're gonna work against this action. But then when you've got Hill and Bell, two of VCU's best players, coming off the bench, that throws a wrench into your preparation, right? And so with the quick turnaround here, just a few days to prepare, I would love to be a fly on the wall for those UNC walkthroughs and see how they're preparing for that, you know. And is it sort of different plans for when Hill is on the floor and when he's not? And Phil said too that he loves to feel that angst from opposing benches when Hill is coming into the game a few minutes in, and how they're changing up their plan. And so as soon as Terrence Hill walks to that scores table, like, I'm going to look to the UNC bench and see what their reaction is, and see how their defensive scheme changes with him on the floor. So that would be another X factor. I'd be fascinated to hear from UNC what the preparation was like when VCU's best player, two of their best players, are coming off the bench, and this team's depth has been such a huge part of its success all year.
Yeah, and Carolina just doesn't have the bench to match either. I mean, the only one person on either team that I feel like we should have mentioned at some point is Zaden High, who's come in since the Wilson injury and shown the ability to hit some threes, grab some rebounds as one of the few people with a tiny shack on Zaden High Island. I do feel the need to bring him up real quick. But yeah, I mean, North Carolina's basically running out him and Kyan Evans and a couple of young freshmen who may not be ready for the moment. VCU's bringing their strength off the bench. So we'll see how that falls as well. But Zach Joachim, where can all the listeners find you?
But works on Richmond.com, man. Thank you so much for the plug. If you just search Zach Joachim, Richmond.com, it all comes up. That's where the Times Dispatch work is. And my Twitter is first name, last name, ZachJuachim. I always appreciate the opportunity to come on, man. You're the best. And oh, wait, can we touch on Leibovitz real quick too, and the new A-10 commissioner? What are your thoughts? He spent time in the Big East, the American, everything that I've seen around the A-10, and I talked to Ed McLaughlin about it at the VCU hotel earlier today too. People have had some pretty glowing stuff to say about him, and they're excited about what he means for the future of the A-10.
Yeah, I gotta go deeper into this. This is like a 2 weeks from now project, but the amount of well wishes and this was a great hire comments by really important people was so kind of such an onslaught that at one point in the day, I actually found myself wanting to see someone say something bad about him just because I was starting to wonder how it was possible that. Oh, John Calipari and Dana O'Neill, and there were some glowing quotes from Rick Barnes that were floating around the other day. They either just hit an absolute grand slam, or my God, this guy is good at getting people to kiss up to him.
And one of the things that stood out from Ed when I talked to him about it, man, Ed McLaughlin, who's the athletic director at VCU, was talking about player retention and about how he felt, you know, Leibovitz was the right guy to keep the best players in the A-10 in the A-10, right? Because I think, you know, people aren't ready to turn to and talk about VCU's offseason yet, but as soon as they do lose, they will be. And obviously, one of the places that you have to start are keeping a Terrence Hill and a Nick Lewis. You know, who were two guys who had phenomenal seasons for this year, underclassmen guards who've still got a lot of college basketball to play ahead of them. And those kind of guys you've got to be able to keep in this league, right? And to be able to put the brand of the A-10 on the stage, that when those guys have seasons like that, they're not looking to make a jump to a power conference. And Ed seemed pretty bullish on Leibovitz's ability to put the A-10 in a position to keep those kinds of players. Obviously, NIL resources are a big part of that. But league branding, league scheduling are also huge parts of it. And so I'm excited to see what the future for the conference holds under his leadership.
Yeah, it seems like this might be a good move, but like I said, we'll dig in the future. I think he's having a press conference next week, so I'm really fascinated to hear the vision he lays out because even if this guy is amazing, a bad vision's going to sink his tenure real quick. And the flip side as well. If he's got great ideas, then I'm good with a lesser candidate. But we'll see. We'll see. That'll be the most fascinating kind of first off-season story here, but Zach, thank you for joining me.
79-77 VCU, Terrence Hill free throw line jumper, shades of Eric Maynor against Duke. Book it.
You're the first, this is the eighth one of these I've done this week. You're the first person to yell out a prediction at the end. So we're gonna get to see if you're right.
It was a 6-11 with VCU and Duke in 2007, I think, right? When Maynor hit that shot. So I don't know. The 11 seed has been kind to VCU in the past. Haven't won an NCAA tournament game in 10 years. Maybe they can break that spell, and the 11 can continue to be magic for the Rams. Man, Tyler, thank you for having me on. You're the best.
Yeah, just don't remind the Duke fans that VCU won that game.
Yeah, then they might not cheer for him.
Let's go into our Georgia St. Louis preview ahead of that game late on Thursday night. And to do that, to break down the Bulldogs, I'm joined by Lance McCurley of UGASports.com, part of the On3 network. Lance, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, man, thanks for having me. I appreciate you reaching out. Super excited to talk about this matchup and just really excited for the tournament to start.
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting one. This seems to be the game that everyone, at least the gamblers, have started to lock in on as points, points, points.
Oh,
That this
yeah.
could be, if we get one game that finishes in the 90s in regulation, it very well might be this one.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a. So I was looking at it before this. I believe Georgia averages 89.9 points per game. It's a program record, and I think that's good for. I mean, it's top 15 in the country, and then right behind them, I think St. Louis is just a few points shy, maybe 86, 87 points a game, which is still top 10, 15. So, like you said, this is one that I think that if both teams play their game, which is a lot in transition, score a lot of points, score in transition, not a lot of defense, then it could get really, really exciting, kind of like Georgia's game against Mississippi State in the regular season finale. I think that was a like a 102-96 game in
Yeah,
Georgia's favor.
one of the most fascinating things in terms of clash of style here, St. Louis, 21st in the nation in tempo. But that's because, but the only reason it's not top 20 is because they're outside of the top 300 in defensive possession length. I mean, they make teams really kind of drag it out on the other end, whereas Georgia's ninth in terms of the quickest offensive possessions in the country, basically dead average in terms of defensive possession length. So St. Louis seems like they're certainly going to be in good shape to kind of get things out and moving. Georgia may have a little bit of resistance there at the very least, but what is the biggest key here for the Bulldogs to just get out and run to get this towards that like 86-84 score that KenPom is projecting?
Well, like I said, Georgia's got to be able to do that and score in transition. And, Georgia doesn't play a lot of defense. I think I got it up right here. Actually, St. Louis only gives up 69.5 points per game, which is ranked 61st nationally. Georgia gives up 79.2 points per game, which is 313th out of 61 games. So that just kind of tells you Georgia's got to come out swinging from the start, which is something that they didn't do in the second round of the SEC tournament against Ole Miss. And for those that St. Louis fans that are going to go back and watch this game, or just anyone watching, Ole Miss got Georgia out of that run and gun type offense that they're used to playing. And I think they only scored 24 points in the second half, but our first half. But then you look in the second half and they're down, I think, 18 or 20 at some point, but they finally get going and clicking on all cylinders, and they're hard to stop. Obviously, it didn't turn up in their favor because they dug themselves in a hole by just that slow start. Not a good percentage from the field, but like I said, Georgia's gonna have to come out swinging. They're going to have to rebound, which they've really, really struggled with. Samto Cirilh, one of the most physical dudes in in this NCAA tournament. I think he's been kicked out of twice, two games this year for some flagrant fouls. Not a dirty player by means, but I mean he's got to get up on the glass. And other guys behind him like Justin Abson and Dylan James are going to have to. They're going to have to, limit Robbie. Is it Robbie Avila from
Avila.
Avila, okay, Avila, I'll remember that. They're gonna have to limit Avila and some of those other Billiken players from out rebounding them. And they're just gonna have to, if Georgia shoots well from three, they're gonna be deadly. We saw that happen in that game against Mississippi State. We saw that game or in that game against Alabama at home. They shot nearly 40% from three. Currently, they're coming into the tournament averaging only 30.1, I think, from the beyond the arc. But like I said, those are kind of the few three or four things that they're going to have to do well. But like I said, they've also been inconsistent at it.
So the rebounding aspect, because St. Louis is nothing special on the glass. I mean, they're certainly better than average, but digging into the Georgia stats, it looks like they did extremely well offensive rebounding in the non-conference, because SEC play, they came in basically dead average. On the defensive glass, they were dead last in the SEC in rebounding rate, and it was not even remotely close. 38%, which is just a truly horrifying number. So we'll see what can really be exploited there. But the 3-point battle, that can go both ways with the St. Louis team, because they would love nothing more than to just get into a run and shoot type of game. But they've also shot themselves out of a couple of games here in the last month. And their last game, the loss to Dayton, I think it's kind of a perfect example of they got red hot in the first 3 minutes and just started leaning heavily on it, and they never found that rhythm again. And I mean, they were even worse in their first game against GW, but they're going to be more than happy to get into that type of battle with an opposing team. But one out of every couple of games, that's going to lead to them shooting themselves in the foot.
And see is what doing a little research on St. Louis, before I came on, they got three guys that shoot over 40, or did shoot at least 40%, which, I think Dion Brown's right there at the 40%. Robbie, what do they call him? The Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
That's what we go with. That's
Is
the best
that,
one. I interviewed him a couple weeks ago. He says that's not his favorite, but I don't know how you get any better than that.
Exactly. And then they got Trey Green, who I think's he's pretty lethal from the 3-point line as well. So Georgia's gonna have to play perimeter defense, and depending on what type of, excuse me, defensive set they're gonna run. St. Louis has got several guys on the floor, besides those three, that can be lethal shooters from that part of the court.
Yeah, top three 3-point shooters in the A-10 this year in Sharma, Green, and Dunlap. So it's a super, super lethal team. But one of my big questions here is just going to be how they attack this Georgia defense, because it's a St. Louis team that wins on efficiency. You go through all the shooting numbers, they are great at making baskets themselves and forcing opponents into misses. And honestly, the only way they end up losing games is when they get crushed on the turnover battle. But who on this Georgia team should we be watching as someone that could slow down this hyper-efficient Billikens offense?
Well, let me go back. Yeah, sorry, back to that 3-point. Yeah, I did. I failed the Northeasters. They got six guys that can shoot it. So yeah, my bad on that. My previous game is blocking it out. But back to your question, I think Cannon Catchings is a guy to watch. He has been really, really hot lately. He kind of came on early. I think it was January 11th against South Carolina. It was Georgia's first, I'd say it's probably first away game, and he scored 30 points. And then he's kind of he's been the more consistent guy, other than Jeremiah Wilkinson, who missed 3 or 4 games during that losing stretch that Georgia kind of had between late January and early to mid-February. But those two guys, are they're two guards. Jeremiah Wilkinson's, like we talked about before, he's a lethal point guard. Coming from Cal, he was, I think, the ACC Sixth Man Player of the Year, maybe Freshman of the Year, something like that. And he's put up several 30 burger games in the SEC. And Cannon Catchings has as well. Catchings had a huge game against Alabama. I think he had 33, 34 points. In that track meet that Georgia had against the Crimson Tide a few weeks ago. So those are two guys that can really, really run the floor and shoot it well from any part of the court. But also Blue Kane. But the problem with Blue Kane is he's just got to get going. He's one of those guys. I think Georgia, technically, I would call him a shooting guard. They use him as a wing. He's probably 6 foot 5, 6 foot 5, 170. But he can, tote the rock from transition to layups, and he can also shoot jumpers, and he's pretty good from the free throw line, or free throw line, and 3-point line as well.
So I do want to go deeper into Blue Kane because the one time I saw Georgia play this year, he absolutely blew me away. I mean, like you said, 6'5", he's slight, but he has unbelievable bounce. This is someone who is one of the best dunkers we've seen in college basketball in a while. And you actually have two of them because you've Dominique Wilkins' kid, Jake, who also threw down a spectacular dunk in the game I saw. So, Apple doesn't fall far from the tree on that one, but Kane is a really fascinating player. He's Georgia's second best rebounder. He's someone who gets to the line a good amount when he gets there, 90.5% on the year. Fantastic shooter from inside the arc, passable enough from three. What type of player do you, because this is the kind of guy where St. Louis's versatility may really come in handy. Like, what type of player would you want to not see matched up against Blue Kane if you're the Georgia coaching staff? What type of guy do you really need to slow him down? Because it feels like there's no kind of great archetype.
No, there's really not. You're gonna need a guy that's gonna be able to match his energy and grit. Because Blue's one of those players. He's diving all over the floor for the ball for a turnover, and he's always putting himself in transition to go to the line. Like we said, he's almost a 91% free throw shooter. I think he's the second leading scorer on the team at 13.3 points per game. You're going to need a guy that's going to be able to match his size, energy, and just be able to just be able to eye him because Georgia runs these high ball screen sets, and Blue Kane's just sitting over there in the corner waiting for a three sometimes. Then he's also kind of the guy that can go in and get that offensive rebound, off the glass and put it back up for two. So they're going to have a guy that is going to need to be able to know where Blue Kane is at all times on the floor.
So I'm trying to think because, like the best body-wise guy St. Louis is going to have to go at him is Amari McCautry, but he's had so many defensive lapses. So he was the guy I was thinking of as you were going through this. But you say someone who needs to know where he is at all times. McCautry's going to know where he is like 15% of the time. So that one's not going to work there. Maybe an undersized Deion Brown to try to attack him. I wish I could credit the show. I've listened to so many different college basketball podcasts the last couple of days prepping for the tournament. I believe it was one of the Three Man Weave guys who mentioned that this Georgia team may just try to drag a couple of the guards down in the post. Is that all going to be just Cyrille off of switches, or some of these wings able to really get down there and get physical as well?
You have, like I mentioned, you have a guy like Cannon Catchings who, he's 6'7", 6'8". You mentioned Jake Wilkins, Dominique Wilkins' son. I think he's a solid 6'8". And, those guys get down there and they bang and they get physical and, they're not afraid to defend. They have several guys like that. Dylan James is another one. I classify him kind of as more of a power forward, but he does get down there outside of Cyrille and just kind of take over the paint sometimes.
So, team's leading scorer, Jeremiah Wilkinson, we should probably get into him at some point since we're already well past the 10-minute mark here. But this is a guy I do remember watching as a freshman at Cal, where he was coming off the bench, just kind of a catch and fire type guy. His whole value was just these big offensive outbursts, and he's a far more efficient shooter this year, up to 35% from three. Is there anything else that he's added to his game, or is this still just a guy who is just going out there, kind of Jamal Crawford-esque, just trying to rack up as many points as he can?
Man, this is a guy who gets a lot of steals. I think he's got 49 steals on the year. He's kind of like Kane, where he's kind of gotten to be a better defender as the years gone along. I remember there was a game earlier this year where I think he had 5 or 6 steals, and I think that all of those points he didn't have a great game shooting from the field, but I think four of those. six steals. He ended up, may scoring in transition and getting buckets. He's gotten to be a better defender. Like I said, as the year's gone on, and he's just another guy that, Georgia has, can also, shoot from the elbow, shoot from the free throw line. But I'd say Jordan Ross is another guy who's a solid option that, kind of gives, he's used to be a starting point guard, gives them, another, is one of those better defenders. They also have Smurf Milner, who I think is the most clutch player on the team. I think he's like a 5'10" guard. He's about as tall as me, but he is a more bit of a liability on defense, but he's another guy that I would watch.
So the one other key guy, and this fits into what really seems to be Georgia's best attributes, other than the fact that this team just doesn't turn the ball over a ton. And if St. Louis has another sloppy game like they've been prone to in the last month, that could be a key thing that really works in the Bulldogs' advantage. But Santo Cirilo, the guy who is powering this awesome 2-point shooting team, fourth in the country at 2-point shooting percentage at 76.5%. I actually don't understand how that's not number one. The Ivica brother is at 83% at Illinois somehow. That's completely insane, but great scorer from inside, leading the team in rebounds. His per 40 on the boards is 11 a game. Only playing 20 minutes though. Is this an injury thing? Is this a stamina? Do they just have an awesome backup? Like, I'm looking at the numbers, wondering why this guy is not a bigger factor.
Santo gets in a lot of foul trouble. I think that first Florida game where he was thrown out 10 minutes into the game for a flagrant foul, flagrant two on Chinyelu from Florida. Teams started, going at him. I think his, minutes per game were around 26, 27 minutes in the non-conference. And then, he gets into conference play and teams just start going at him from that point on. So they'd have to, there've been a lot of times where, Georgia's had to kind of win without Sancto. Kind of like that South Carolina game. I think he got two, three, within the first, 24, 25 minutes of the game, and, has to sit, with just how big Sancto is. He's probably the largest human being I've ever seen, just in terms of, from me to him. And he's just built like a tree. And he's got such a long wingspan that, he got tied up with one of Ole Miss's guards the other night, and got a flagrant foul. He plays very physical, but there are also times where, he struggles to be inconsistent on the glass, and will lash out and throw kind of throw elbows, throw hands. So he's a guy that needs to keep his emotions under check, but a lot of that is why he's not on the floor as much.
How is he guarding out on the perimeter? Because he's going to have to do a lot of that in this one.
He's gonna have to stand with his hands straight up and try to avoid contact, or try to avoid as much contact as possible.
I mean, that might be one of the most fascinating battles within the game, because the way you talk about him, I assume they're just going to stick him on one of the forwards, throw him at the rim, but that leaves the awkward part. I guess it'll probably have to be catching guarding Avila out on the perimeter. He's not going to give up all that much size to him though. 6'9", 220.
Yeah, but it's just one of those things where, you can, Santos should not be guarding the perimeter. He's obviously, 6 foot, 6'10", close to 7 feet. And, he's one of those guys that literally takes up the entire lane. And, he plays physical, but Santos can move for a big man as well. So I can see him, if there's no help side on that side where Avila's shooting a three, get his hand in his face. But Santo's a guy that probably needs to stay inside the paint, and because he is Georgia's really only, rebounder. They have a couple guys that I mentioned, Justin Abson, and Dylan James, who are kind of guys that, haven't really thrived in SEC play. I've been with Georgia for a few years, but they're not nearly as good a rebounder as Sompto.
So keys to the game with the obvious caveat that if one of these teams just hits five or six more threes than the other, they're probably going to win in an environment like this. But the two big things that I'm wondering about, just real potential weaknesses for this team, I think Georgia's probably going to win the turnover battle no matter what. St. Louis, just not the type of team that's going to make a team that does a good job of taking care of the ball start to all of a sudden stray away from that. But can the Billikens themselves keep the turnover battle close? And then just can Cyril keep himself on the floor? Because I wish we had actually led the whole episode with that discussion. I think his kind of slow feet are going to be very critical in just seeing how this game goes.
Yeah, of course. And like you said, he's gonna, say, so Georgia has had a lot of turnover problems in the past. This year, that's one of those things that I think Mike White, Georgia's head coach, has tried to clean up. Like I said, I think they're only averaging, 10 a game. The last year, I think, it was, 13, 14 a game, which has killed them. But, this year they've done a better job of protecting the ball. And, 10 a game's not bad for a team that plays as fast as they do.
Any other keys that you got that you've been thinking about as you start to prep for this matchup?
Like I said, they're gonna have to do the hope that they're gonna have to defend the three well, because as I thought that St. Louis has only had a couple guys averaging over 40 points for BYU. I was back and looked while we're sitting here talking. Yeah, they've got several guys that are lethal from behind the arc. And I think that St. Louis is a better 3-point shooting team. So, statistically, that backs that up. So they're going to have to defend the perimeter really, really well. And like I said, they're going to have to out rebound. There have been very few games this year where Georgia has won the rebounding battle. And I think I remember back the Tennessee game. That was an overtime game. Georgia should have won at home. Tennessee had 42 rebounds with 3 minutes and 40 seconds to go. Georgia had 22. Tennessee had 22 offensive rebounds at that point. So Georgia's going to have to win the battle on the boards if they want to win comfortably. If St. Louis wins the battle of the boards, where Georgia shot a little bit well from three, I'd take Georgia all day. But, like I said, I've seen this movie too many times where, Georgia just hasn't put up the effort consistently to be able to grab those offensive and defensive rebounds.
All right, we'll see what happens down in the paint in this one. Lance, where can all the people find your work? They want to learn more about this Georgia team.
So I cover Georgia football, Georgia baseball, Georgia basketball. If they're ever interested in football, just had their pro day today. So I had a lot of coverage over on my Twitter at LM underscore sports underscore media. And then on Instagram, my handle is Live Action by Lance. I take a lot of photos down on the sidelines, in the dugout and on the gridiron. So, I'm kind of all over at Georgia sports wise.
All right, everyone, go follow Lance, get a little peek into what's going on down in SEC country. And thank you for joining me.
Yeah, man, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you to Zach Joachim as well. Thank you to all of you for listening. Be back probably on Friday, unless both of these teams get eviscerated. If someone wins, absolutely, we'll be back with a recap and a second round preview. So tune in for that.